Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News Now, in depth on what it would take to put a dent in the price we pay for drugs.
U.S. drug companies have produced extraordinary results for our country, but the pricing has been astronomical for our country.
It's President Trump, within days of his inauguration, meeting with the CEOs of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the U.S. He warned them that prices have to come down. Getting there isn't simple, and we're going to talk about why. Here's some context you may not know about pricing. Drug companies set their own prices for medication. Few other countries in the world do that. The U.S. government allows companies to hold a monopoly on a drug, barring generics from entering the marketplace for a certain amount of time. The approval process through the FDA takes a long time, and President Trump wants to streamline that. And American pharma companies insist that the only way to recoup their research and development costs is to charge high prices for the medications that they're developing. So our guests are going to give us their view on this. Your experience is valuable as well. Are you or is someone in your family taking a medication that's extremely expensive? And I'd like to know how you manage the cost of that. So if you're on a drug or someone in your family is taking a medication that is pretty cost prohibitive, how are you financing that? How are you affording that? And what does it mean for the rest of your budget? Phone numbers here, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter, at CarrieMPR. And our guest, Sarah Ellison, is a professor of economics at MIT, where she researches demand and pricing of pharma medicine. And she's with us today from Cambridge, Mass. And Sarah, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks very much. Happy to be here.
Wally Jelad is Associate Professor of Medicine and Health Policy at the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health, and he's with us from Pittsburgh. He said he was going to put on a fake Minnesota accent for this show.
I changed my mind.
You did. Wise man. Welcome. It's really good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah, I think we're going to be talking a lot about the motivation and the decision-making from pharmaceutical companies. So I want to know about how much of what we pay for a statin or a cancer drug is because the leaders, the CEO at that company, have decided, well, that's what the cost should be. I mean, how much autonomy is there in this?
Well, I mean, you know, economists who study this issue, and I'm one of them, sort of like to think about firms making optimal decisions given sort of all the information they have and the markets that they operate in. And the decisions are based on the cost of research and development, the regulatory costs, and also the sort of structure of demand, and in particular, how price sensitive the demand that they face is for the drugs that they're selling. And the sort of sensitivity of the demand is the thing that really disciplines the pricing. And so to a first approximation, we think of pharmaceutical firms as basically choosing an optimal price given the sensitivity of the demand they face and their costs. And so the moving parts there are can we do something to make demand more sensitive, for instance, the price?
And Waleed, I know that's no different than many other products where the company decides what the market will bear and what the price should be. But I guess I'm wondering whether pharmaceutical companies have to be accountable to any kind of regulatory agency and perhaps whether they should be when it comes to prices, when it comes to what they're going to charge.
The companies are accountable for a lot of issues, actually, to regulatory agencies. And technically, actually, they are accountable actually for price in that there are pieces of statute and legislation that do allow the government to do things about a drug if its price causes problems with access. But that really hasn't – the regulatory agencies have not acted on those. And there are other, I guess, more indirect ways that regulatory agencies may impact price in terms of allowing importation if they were to do that, or increasing access to generics by reducing barriers to entry. So there are a lot of ways that regulatory agencies can do this. But, you know, when we I see patients, and when we talk about regulatory agencies and we talk about demand, you know, it's – these are drugs that, in many cases, are life-saving, and it's a different problem than other goods and services that we think about typically.
And Sarah, that makes this fairly unusual in the United States, isn't it? That the price that a pharmaceutical company will charge is not directly regulated by some agency, isn't that right?
That's correct. In lots of countries, especially countries that don't have big pharmaceutical sectors themselves, they have very strict controls on prices.
Let me go to the phones here to Lanka in Minneapolis. Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
What does this budget issue mean for the medications that you or someone in your family is taking?
So my mother is diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. She has been for the last 12 years or so. Mm-hmm. And there's one particular medication that there is no generic brand for. It's called Nupro. It's a patch. And it costs us monthly $312 a month, which is an astronomical price for one medication. And with her disease, she takes multiple medications. And on average, we spend anywhere from $500 to $700 a month.
Wow.
On just her medication.
Yeah. So your mother would take the generic if she could, but she specifically needs this.
If it was even available, correct. Yeah, there isn't a generic available, unfortunately, and there's nothing of the kind. She takes medications every 2 hours. The patch helps her with pain-associated symptoms with Parkinson's.
Okay.
And the good thing about the patch is it's just a 24-hour patch. It's a slow drug delivery system. And it helps her with the pins and needles and a little bit of her shakiness. And it's the only thing that we found that has worked for her to relieve these symptoms. And it's not something that she can go without. So we end up just paying these astronomical prices. And the funny thing is, prior to her going on Medicare, it was only $20, and because she had a coupon. And so when I contacted the company to see if we were able to kind of redeem a coupon under Medicare, they informed me that unfortunately the government has strict rules that they can't offer any kind of subsidy, and they have to pay the full amount with Medicare.
Waleed, may I ask how many of your patients are in the kind of situation that Lanka is in, which is it's a need of a specific drug and there aren't a lot of options?
Yeah, I think that happens time and time again. And I will tell you, I see patients also at the VA where there's a much different issue. And actually, many people will come, if they have access to the VA system, will come to the VA specifically to get around this issue. That exactly what you talked about. In Medicare, because of rules about kickbacks, coupons aren't allowed, and cost sharing can be very high. And so often the VA is actually an outlet for some of these patients to come. But I will tell you, I see this time and time and time and time again. And the other piece I just want to mention, because this really brings up the issue that there's not one drug price problem. There are many.
Mm.
And what you just talked about is one of the issues when there's no generic, but the drug might be expensive. You know, that's very different from the issue of generics rising in price.
Sarah, I think this goes to what we're talking about right now. You've talked about the federal government making agreements with generic drug manufacturers to make cheaper medications. And you've said that maybe the effect will be a spillover effect, and it would bring the rest of the prices in the market down. Does that apply to what we're talking about right now, and why hasn't that been done?
Well, I guess sort of a general point that I should probably make is that there's always a trade-off between lowering drug prices and giving firms incentives to innovate. And so whenever we talk about lowering drug prices, we have to sort of think of it through that lens. And, you know, is something, an action that the government might take, mm-hmm. is that something that could decrease incentives to innovate more than we would like?
Okay, Sarah, before you go on, I want to make sure I understand what you're saying, because this is the argument that you hear from pharmaceutical companies, right? If you force mm-hmm. us to charge less for our medications, then we may not have the money to put into the research and development of these drugs that so many people need. I mean, does that argument hold, do you think, economically?
Well, I think the argument, I would restate it slightly. I would say that they wouldn't have the incentives to
okay.
to develop new drugs if they knew that they would not be able to receive some, price above their cost of manufacturing once they brought it to market.
Is anybody saying, Waleed, just one moment, is anybody saying that they wouldn't be able to charge whatever the cost is to bring it to market, but that they might have to take less for some of the exorbitant profits that they're making on some of these drugs? Is anybody saying it's one or the other, not somewhere in the middle?
Sorry, could you ask that question again?
I'm saying nobody is saying to the pharmaceutical companies it's either you bring the drug to the market for the exact price and you don't really get to make much of a profit, or you get to charge whatever you want and make exorbitant profits on some of these drugs. Isn't there somewhere in the middle that would work
and make
these drugs more affordable?
Yeah, no, absolutely. The only point I make about sort of mentioning this trade-off is that, when pharmaceutical companies are charging below, when some government action or some other economic action causes them to lower their prices, then the incentives to innovate also go down. I'm not making any kind of a claim about what the optimal incentives to innovate are.
Okay. Waleed, forgive me. Waleed, sorry for interrupting. You were going to say.
Oh, no. I was just going to say, what I love is that in just 10 minutes in this discussion, we've gotten to what is the fundamental underlying issue that underlies all these questions about drug price, which is how much profit or at what price is it necessary that we still develop new drugs that can help us? And in the end, it's an unanswerable question. And that's why the debate just goes on and on, because this is what we end up going to, is that there is this trade-off, and yet no one can tell us what the right level is, at the right level of profit at which we will still get new drugs in the future.
Is it really unanswerable, Waleed, or is it that there is not the political will to have a true debate about this?
Well, I think in Minnesota, you all have two senators who I think are happy to engage in this discussion. But I think if the answer, it is actually unanswerable, what is the right amount of profit? I think that question is unanswerable. And so often the answer you'll hear is, well, we'll let the market decide. But there's really no market for these things. And so really, I think it's unanswerable in the situation we have now.
Sarah, you think that's right?
Well, I think I broadly agree with that. I would add the caveat that there are government actions that could be taken that preserve the incentives to innovate for firms, but can also result in lower prices. And one such government action would be the government actually purchasing particular drugs and making them available. So purchasing at the market price, mm-hmm. Purchasing the firm or the part of the firm that manufactures a particular drug, purchasing that at the sort of market price that Wall Street would value the firm at,
uh-huh.
and then selling the drugs at, cost or maybe even below cost.
Waleed, why doesn't the federal government do that?
Yeah, and I've seen the debate about buying companies. You know, it's very interesting, but the problem is you are still then rewarding a company for setting a high list price. And the example that's been talked about recently is Gilead with the hepatitis C drugs, in that it would be cheaper if we actually just bought Gilead or bought the rights to use that drug for a large amount of money than to pay the current price. But the only reason that's true is because the price has been set so high. And, you know, the question is, again, why was the price set so high? Was that the fair price? And again, it's a very difficult question to answer. But I think the problem I have with the idea of buying with the government purchasing firms is that we are still rewarding companies for setting the price high. And really, it's not about supply and demand. It is simply about how much the government is willing to pay.
Yeah, I think I hear you saying you're not interfering on the incentive for them to continue to charge high prices.
Right. And the reason why we're even talking about this is because prices are so high. And so the companies will set their price very high because they realize that if they do that, then the government will decide that it will purchase the drug for use by itself at a very high price. And so what incentive is that really to start out at a lower price?
Mark says on Twitter, healthcare pricing by supply and demand. What's the demand, the price for a drug you need to save your child's life? Supply and demand equals crazy. And to another Mark in St. Paul, Mark, you're a doctor, is that right?
Oh, yes. And I'm glad your guest has brought up the issue with Gilead and the Hep C drugs. We have experience with my family. My father just took a course of the Hep C drugs, and I think the drugs are $80,000 for a course. Of course, our family never saw that exact cost because of health insurance. This conversation is tied into health insurance coverage because everyone, you know, has different health coverage, and it's hard to know across the board how much any patient will pay for a drug because of their own health insurance. And as a physician, there are a number of times when we have to modify a care plan because of cost of drugs. But it's hard to do without a lot of back and forth and thinking, because it's really hard to know beforehand how much someone is going to pay for a drug anyway.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah. I appreciate the call, Mark. Thank you. I thought we would hear from Marcy in St. Paul as well. Marcy, what's your experience with a medication that you need?
I have multiple sclerosis, and the only way that I can afford it is that there's a charity that helps, because it's a total of $6,000 a month.
Wow. For the drug that you're taking?
Yes. Every multiple sclerosis drug that I've ever taken has been in the same cost range, and they're all injectables, although they're starting to have pills now that are just as expensive. So Medicare pays, as I'm looking at my prescription drug thing right here, mm-hmm. and the plan paid $2,056, I paid $2,053, and the Medicare coverage gap discount program paid another $2,069 for a total of more than $6,000 per month.
Wow, my gosh.
For one drug. I have a few other drugs I have to take, but that's the crazy one. The other drugs are all under a couple of hundred a month.
Yeah.
So that's why I felt I had to call when someone says, well, $300 a month is really a lot. It's like $300 is a month. $300 is a lot. Well, try $3,000 to $6,000.
Right. Waleed, how unusual is this? Do you know?
Yeah, no, it's not unusual at all. And the problem is it's becoming less unusual, or it's becoming more typical, because most of the new drugs, many of the new drugs being being developed are these expensive drugs. And this issue about charities that Marcy brought up is such a huge issue. It is often the only way that patients can afford the drugs. And what happens is those individuals who qualify for the charity will get the drug at a low cost, and otherwise the high cost of the drug is diffused among thousands or millions of people through insurance. And so that was the comment from Mark before about how we don't know who faces the drug, but this is common. This is the problem. There is a drug price problem that patients feel, and there is a drug price problem that society is dealing with, and they're very different, and Marcy really just outlined the problem that patients are facing.
Leo in Minneapolis called to say, I'm a type 1 diabetic, and we are hearing from a number of diabetics here. He says, very costly. I spend $1,500 a year just on test strips. I don't think when people talk about diseases, they understand all of the costs. I wanted to ask you, too, about this bill in Congress that would require the National Institute of Health to exercise its patent rights. And as I understand this, correct me if this isn't accurate, when NIH funds go into research that leads to a new drug, the NIH could say, well, we're going to exercise our investment, our patent on that, and we're going to control the price of those drugs. Sarah, do I have that right?
So, I believe that the exact law allows for the NIH to require that the patent holder license the intellectual property to third parties.
Okay.
And so that could have the effect of basically the government, the NIH determining what to charge for these drugs.
So here's a real life example of this. Texas Congressman Lloyd Daggett tried to get the NIH to do this last year with this prostate cancer drug called Xtandi, I think it's called. Costs about $88 a pill. NIH money had gone into that development. And the NIH, Waleed, said that it didn't have the authority to do this. And now I understand there's a debate about whether it actually does. Would this be a partial solution to some of what we're talking about today?
Well, this drug, enzalutamide, Xtandi, is a good example. And Sarah was right that it's not allowing the NIH to control the price, but it is saying if the price reaches a certain level, at which time it starts impeding access, then it will allow the license to go to someone else so other companies can make it. And when you have multiple manufacturers, that'll reduce the price. But that is this is one way that the price could be lowered. And what many have asked, what some have asked about Marchand is not necessarily that it be used or this government patent use, or if specifically we're talking about Marchand rights, but that the government set the criteria at which it will be used. And that may be enough of a shot across the bow that it will do something about price without actually pursuing the actual Marchand. So just setting the criteria and making it clear that the government would do this would be enough potentially to lower price. And the government has not been even willing to go that far and say the criteria that it would use at which time it would go in and march in on the patent rights.
So, Sarah, do you think there is serious interest in doing this in Congress or not?
Well, that's not something I think I can speculate on, but I can reiterate what Dr. Jalad said, what he just claimed, which is that putting political pressure on pharmaceutical companies has in the past been an effective way mm-hmm. to moderate prices without any specific government regulation and prices whatsoever. The political visibility and the political pressure, that has been determined to be a moderating influence on pharmaceutical prices.
Okay, call here from Liz in Minneapolis. Hi, Liz. Thank you for waiting.
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
I'm married to a woman, and my spouse is on a drug that is a life-saving medication. She's been living with chronic myelogenous leukemia since her 20s, but this drug is fairly new. She built up resistance to a drug called Gleevec that was put out in the early 2000s and now switched to this other drug called Sprycel. And basically, these drugs have turned what was a terminal illness, a death sentence, into a chronic, manageable disease or condition, except for the fact that this particular drug that she's on costs, and I don't mean to get into healthcare Olympics here, but it does cost $15,300 a month in
wow.
the United States.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, exactly. We found out it's apparently produced in Canada for about $5,000 or $6,000. And so, not only is the pool of people dependent on this drug growing mm-hmm. each year, but I also think that the pharmaceutical company has to change its bottom line, moving from, how do we make more money to incentivize research and development to how do we value human life, and let that be the incentive, especially because this is a life-saving drug, and the only reason why we can afford it, just to bring some intersectionality to the discussion, is because my ancestors in this country made a boatload of money off of the backs of enslaved people. And so that's how we can afford it, because my family is supporting us with these initial co-pays and so forth until we meet our out-of-pocket. But I just would like to see, I mean, this is just one example of how we need to shift the conversation from making money to saving human lives.
Yeah, Liz, I really appreciate you sharing your own personal situation with this. Waleed, it does kind of bring us back to when we were talking about how much is enough, right, mm-hmm. for the pharmaceutical companies.
Right, and that's what this boils down to. The issue is, yes, it is true, at least the studies have shown that if you reduce price, there will be reduced incentives for research and development. The question is, how much lower will research and development incentives go, and can you still innovate? And on the other hand, can you take that money saved and plow it into other things that we know improve life? You know, whether it's vaccines, whether it is substance abuse treatment, you know, whether it is right now, for example, Medicare does not pay for dentures or hearing aids. And so we're making trade-offs about drugs. And the question is, can we accept a slightly reduced incentive for pharmaceutical companies to do research and development, knowing that it will save us billions of dollars, which we can potentially use for other things? And
yeah, I'm asking for a different conversation culturally here. I mean, Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, of course, was just aired on HBO, and my spouse is alive because of HeLa cells. And so how do we switch the conversation from, you know, incentivizing development and research because of money versus incentivizing research and development because it's the right thing to do?
Let me take that to Sarah as well.
Well, I mean, I'm very sympathetic with this notion that we can, as a society, sort of value things other than profit. I mean, I think that's uncontroversial in my book. But the pharmaceutical companies are sort of for-profit companies, and they're controlled by their shareholders, and the shareholders are interested in, behavior that's profit-maximizing. And I think that that's sort of, you know, maybe we can think about methods for funding pharmaceutical research that are outside of the for-profit sphere, but certainly sort of changing the conversation within the confines of the for-profit pharmaceutical companies is a very difficult thing to do.
I'm really grateful for the insight that you've both brought to the conversation. I think this is something that the economics of this, Sarah and Waleed, are really mystifying to a lot of Americans, and you've brought some clarity to that. So thank you so much.
Sure. My pleasure.
My pleasure.
Sarah Ellison is a professor of economics at MIT. Waleed Gilad is co-director of the Center for Pharmaceutical Policy and Prescribing at the University of Pittsburgh's School of Public Health. Now, I'm hearing from some of you on Twitter who caught the last part of my conversation with our guest from Breitbart News, John Carney. Yes, I am inviting him back for a conversation specifically about where and how Breitbart fits in to our journalistic environment today. So look forward to that, and we'll let you know when that's coming up soon.